Hello, and welcome to this, another episode of Frame and Reference. I'm your host, Kenny McMillan, and you're listening to episode 130 with Eric Messerschmidt, ASC, DP of Ferrari. Enjoy.
I was lucky enough to see the Ferrari screening with Michael Mann and Denis Villeneuve.
Oh, cool.
And at the Academy screening or whatever. And then they were just hanging out, eating snacks with everyone. I figured they would have bailed real quick.
Sure.
So I got to meet them. So that was cool. But I feel like that was like the best way to experience it. Are you cool talking about The Killer a little bit? Because I think there's an interesting like comparison and contrast. Plus, everyone's lucky enough to have the most recent ASC magazine where the two compared and contrasted.
Right.
But I did notice, because I learn in comparison, is my point. But both films have very naturalistic lighting and are very kind of similar in approach, it feels, but completely different looks.
Yeah.
Which obviously ties into the similar DP. But I was wondering kind of what the approach was for Ferrari on... obviously locations are going to be very helpful, you know, those all your like actual literal locations. From our last conversation, did you learn anything from Devotion, you know, having all that action and whatnot, which is another film that didn't look particularly stylized. Is that just kind of your approach, or do all three of those directors kind of ask that of you, or is that just kind of how things shake out?
I mean, I think I'm my automatic place of, you know, where I start is from naturalism. I just think it's like, you know, if we're photographing something, it shouldn't be like, it should sort of come from a place of realism. You know, I mean, Gordon Willis is my hero.
Sure.
You know, I think he was doing stuff that no one else was doing, and he was, you know, he wasn't just putting someone in a glamorous key light because there's space off the camera right and she looks great when she's lit from camera right. You know, he was like considering what the environment is, and, you know, not a lot of people were doing that at that time. Really, you know, people were still very stuck in this kind of Hollywood, well, this is how you do it, this is how you light a close up, you know? But for me, it just makes kind of logical sense. It's like the environment should be real. It should remind the audience of what that place is. You know, in the case of Ferrari, there's, you know, absolutely like visual references that we were using, in particular, like Italian painting, you know.
I literally wrote down Caravaggio.
Yeah, good. I mean, that's what Michael said. Yeah. Oh, good. But, you know, but Caravaggio came from a place of realism too. You know, the light comes from what's in the frame. You know, he's like, the light comes from the candle. The light comes from the window. And then it's like the subtle use of contrast and direction and blocking and stuff all supports that idea, but it all comes from a place of, well, what does the space look like? You know, for me, it's like the second I try to think outside of that, you know, like where I'm sitting now, there's a big window in front of me. You know, I could block the window and I could put a light over here and I could shape it. It never looks as good. It just doesn't, you know, if I like try to manipulate it out of what it kind of naturally is. It's like force feeding something, you know?
Right.
But I mean, I also think simplicity is always better, and like less stuff is always better. It's like, you have to like, you know, the director should be nimble. The director should feel like they're not constrained by all this stuff. Unless they're like, look, I want it to look super stylized. I want this, and this. It's like, okay, well, that's going to change, you know, where we can put the camera. You know, I mean, The Killer is stylized, but it's all stylized from a place of like, you know, naturalism, I think. And Ferrari's very much the same way.
How do you, for like people who are starting out or whatever, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, keep it simple. And then someone goes off and does that and it looks incredibly, like you can see the light, you know, like one thing that really helped me out was just getting a color meter lights that actually had like XY coordinates and just matching, like exactly matching everything.
But,
kind of what are maybe some pitfalls you see when people try to work with the given light and then it just doesn't quite look natural?
For me, it's all about camera direction. It's like where you put the camera. Like you can either make it really hard for yourself, you can make it really easy, you know? When people go for that look and they fail, it's usually because they're putting the camera in a place where that just doesn't work. You know, it's like, for me, like every location has like two or three good shots maybe, and then a lot of really shitty ones. And it's, you know, and ultimately it's like, hopefully the director is on board or they're aesthetically inclined where they can see that. I find sometimes people are attracted to locations, and not because they're like, not because of the visual opportunities that they offer, but because of the story opportunity that they offer. And then there's occasionally conflict there, you know, like, people love the feel of a location when they walk into it. You know, sometimes directors, they walk in, they're like, just love how this feels. It doesn't mean that feeling is going to be, it's going to be communicated to the audience though, you know, or they have sometimes people make autobiographical films and they want to go shoot in their hometown and they're like, it just doesn't look like how they imagine it, you know? And it ends up being like, well, what are the aesthetic things that remind you of this place that make this place special, and how do we exploit it, you know? And usually there's like two things. It's not 15 things.
Right.
I think people get really obsessed with equipment. I think they get, you know, they want they read American Cinematographer or whatever, and like, oh, I want to use this piece of camera, or I want to use this camera, or so-and-so shot with these lenses, I have to have these lenses. I just don't really believe that. I just don't. Most of the good work I've done, I could probably do on an iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Well, to that point, I think this is going to sound absurd to certain people, but like just picking a V-Raptor and a Sumalux is that's a pretty like neutral base.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't believe that I just don't think it's the camera that gives you the look. And I don't think it's the,
right.
You know, I think there's
Stan Sasaki who gives you the look.
Well, he can help, you know, he can certainly help, but that's, you know, that's all icing on the cake, man. That's like the last 2%. Yeah. It's not, you know, that's not the decision. You know, like I do commercials all the time. People are like, oh, I want to shoot anamorphic. Okay.
I hope you don't have a product.
Well, you know, it's to me, that's not where the look comes from.
Yeah.
It's not where the drama comes from. It's not where it's certainly a choice you make, but it shouldn't be the primary choice. Like, I don't think of it as like the most important, you know, like the most important choice is all about the cinema grammar and how you're going to tell a story. And, you know, I can, you know, shallow depth of field and close focus and all that stuff. Like, there's like 400 different ways to achieve that kind of thing, you know, all with subtle differences. But they don't make the commercial better, and they don't make the movie better. You know, the like what's in front of the camera has to make the movie better, and where and how we sequence it. That's really what matters. It's like, you know, I'd love to stand here and be like, oh, it's all about the cinematography. It's really not. I just don't believe that anymore. You know.
Well, it was you guys who taught me sort of surreptitiously about how the importance, and I've mentioned this on this podcast many times, but like the importance of production design. And yeah, how like that makes you as a DP look way better than any camera or lens could possibly do for you.
100%. I mean, like the painter is the most important person, you know, like how we're going to, you know, how do we keep the walls dark? How do we, you know, how do we maintain separation? How do we, you know, it's like a bad set is really hard to light. A good set is really easy to light.
You know, that actually reminds me of two things. Well, hold on. Let me write. I've started writing notes in the middle of conversations instead of forgetting every five fucking seconds. So that's an upgrade since the last time we spoke. Your episode's actually the most listened to episode.
It's oh no,
the top five. The top five are a narrow margin, but you are technically number one. There we go. I did want to add, because you had mentioned the anamorphic thing with commercials. Is it reasonable or practical to kind of do the thing that you guys have done, like The Killer or Mindhunter, where you art direct flares and all that on a commercial, or does that take a little bit too much time in VFX for something that potentially might not have the budget?
Well, everyone has to be on board. You know, it's like, I'm doing that on a commercial now, actually, a job. I'm going to shoot a job next week where we're going to do that. But, you know, commercial things is tricky because what happens a lot these days, especially in the United States, less so in Europe, but in the United States, is the agency just takes the footage and then you don't participate in it anymore.
Oh, interesting.
You know, in fact, I see commercials sometimes that get graded by somebody. I'm like, wow, you made that decision. Okay, well.
I didn't know I shot that.
You know, that's not how I shot it. You know, I mean, that's the Faustian bargain you sign up for when you shoot a commercial. You know, I mean, that's the arrangement. And that's made very clear, you know, so it's like really elaborate kind of post workflows that require a lot of nuanced thought and consideration are maybe not recommended in those kind of environments, you know?
Right.
But sometimes people, you know, really get into it. Like they might see the killer and be like, I want to do that look. So, well, okay, well you have to do X, Y, and Z. It's totally practical. I mean, it's not sophisticated, but you know, in terms of the application technique and the equipment required stuff, it requires people looking at it and tweaking it. You know, it's not like, it's not a plugin you just drag and drop in After Effects and be like, oh, here's the killer look, you know?
Right.
I
did notice you guys were using Scatter in terms of plugins.
I love Scatter
more or less, but it only works on Apple.
Yeah,
can't use it. In my job at Pro Video, I had a bunch because I was reviewing like all these film emulation DCTLs, and someone was like, "Oh, you got to do Filmbox," or because they have like a few things besides Scatter. And I was like, "I'd love to. I gotta wait."
You
guys.
A friend of mine sent it to me. Another DP, Mark Doring Powell, sent it to me. He was an old friend of mine, cinematographer, ASC member, and because we're always trading like geeky stuff like that. It's like, I was like, oh, this is interesting, and I sent it to Pincher, and he was skeptical, of course. He's like, well, shoot a test, show me. And we shot a test. He was like, oh, okay, we could use this.
Yeah.
I don't use diffusion filters very often. I
gave up on them.
Yeah.
Everything's always backlit.
Really frustrating. Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, I always get the effects. I get the effects when I don't want them, and I don't get enough when I do, and I can't control it. You can't pan from a hot window to somebody else, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't, less stuff.
I wish they could be tunable. I mean, I guess that's what you're doing in post, but like where you could like like a rotopola. But for filtration.
Well, that's the great thing about Scatter is you can keyframe it, you know, so you could start on a back, you know, on a window, and then you can, you could be at a quarter or whatever, and then you could pan over against a dark background. And you can increase the value, you can't do that practically. I mean, to me, it's like, it's all about the final look. It has nothing to do with, I'm not nostalgic about it. I'm just not. It's not like, oh, well, I have to use diffusion filters because that's how, Stanley Cortez would have done it. And it's like, well, I think Stanley Cortez would have used every single tool at his disposal as well. You know, it's like, right. Like I always try to think about the end result, and what the best path to that is, you know, not so much about like, you know, it's like the film digital conversation. You know, it's the same thing. It's like, well, what do you actually want it to look like? You know?
Well, now people want it to, I've noticed, people want it to be 4:3. Want it to be VHS-y. And sure. Now I've noticed in commercials, tell me if you've gotten this in a brief, not every commercial, but like 50% of commercials almost have a still photography on camera flash thing going on. Like it's just like collages of still photos.
Sure.
That shot with an on camera flash. And I'm like, this is so fascinating because I could absolutely do that for you, American Express.
You're right.
That's very.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you know. Like it's cyclical, I guess, and people look at the trends of who, you know, what sort of images are influencing people. You know, we live in a time now where Instagram and TikTok, the 9x16 frame is oftentimes like more, it reaches more eyeballs than the 16x9 frame.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah.
You know, and I don't really fault anybody for that. I mean, I obviously like to shoot stuff in landscape. When I take iPhone photos, it's always horizontal.
I actually you know, have an anamorphic lens for my phone.
That's
that
cool.
I put an ND filter on it, but I've started playing with that now.
That's funny.
I thought you were going to go. sorry. I did want to return to sets though, because in Ferrari, there's two. Where's my note? I saw this in November. So I'm trying to remember. Talked about the Godfather influence a little bit. Oh, the top. So there was two sets. The office set, like that kind of green office set, and then where did it go? They have an argument in like a living room. I noticed something kind of interesting about the office. It's incredibly sparse.
Yeah,
and I was wondering what the what's the point. What was kind of the decision making? Because it's literally just green walls. Like I would expect something on there. My filmmaker brain was kind of
Of course, but that's what Enzo's office looked like.
Of course.
No, in fact, at the Ferrari Museum in Modena, there's a recreation of his office, and it's exactly that. It's a simple brown desk with a telephone, a photograph of his son, and a pen. And nothing on the walls, no books, no imagery, nothing. And that was important to Michael. You know, Michael wanted to, you know, of course, like the art director kind of cinematographer brain of yours is like, well, can we put a picture on the wall back there? Maybe we can break it up. It wouldn't be realistic. And that's really important to Michael. And, when we lit it, I just overhead fluorescence. I put the fluorescence on and the windows kind of blown out. And,
you use actual fluorescence for that room?
I did.
Ah,
I did. Yeah.
I figured I love Kinos, but I bet at this point it's like it's even something like a mega light cloth or whatever, you know, just those massive light blankets.
Right.
So easy.
No, I mean, we see them in the frame sometimes and it's like.
Oh, sure.
It's always tricky for me that this balance of how much stuff to put up in the sky to kind of make your life easier and against how that's going to influence the director's choices and where we can put the camera. The second you start arming in backlights and putting up pipe and it does start to look very studio lit really quickly.
Right.
That wouldn't have been right for this movie. I mean, this movie is basically, it's all about soft frontal top light. And that's kind of what Italian painting looks like. You know, like if you look at a Titian or a Tintoretto portrait, you know, it's all kind of lit from here. It's kind of lit like I'm lit now. You know, people might be like, oh, well, that's flat. And it's like, well, yeah, it is, because it's all about color contrast. You know, it's not, it's about, and Caravaggio too. I mean, Caravaggio is all that hard sun, soft light, this like distant, far, you know, soft light that sort of, that almost looks hard because it's through the aperture of the window, you know. Right. But it's all single source, and sometimes sometimes people are lit quite flat. Actually, it's just the contrast of the entire image is stunning. But I don't know. I always like walk into the set. And it's like, well, what should be there? You know, it's the worst thing when you work with a designer or something where you walk into the set and it doesn't look like anything before you've done any. You know, like we should be able to walk in, the practical should be on, and it should look like a workable space.
Right.
In my opinion. You know, it's like if it's an office, there should be the lighting in there that it would be for an office. And then we can turn it off and tweak it, obviously. But like it should always start there. It's like, you know, it's like, well, you're going to light it, right? It's like, well, no. Like it has to be lit and then we'll adjust, you know.
In my head, for whatever reason, an analogy that popped up was Disneyland queue lines. They're very pre-lit, you know. You would never go into there and be like, how are we going to fix this? For if you were to fix there for whatever fucking
I mean, you know, it's like it should be something.
I was just thinking that office being so sparse in reality is such a interesting character trait, because in the film obviously it's, you can get the opinion that he cares more about Ferrari, the company, than his family. But not only does that not suggest it, but I also don't believe that's the case.
Right.
I think he was just, it seems like, you would know more, you studied the guy, but like, it does seem like he did care more about his family and was really bad at showing it.
Sure. Well, I mean,
cheating, et cetera, but I guess that's very Italian.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the movie is all about these polar opposite forces pulling on Enzo, you know, his family, the factory, that, you know, business against racing and all of that stuff. You know, the two women in his life, the children in his life. I think that's very much, very, very much the movie. And that's kind of why we wanted the movie to have two very different looks. You know, you're in the kind of dramatic portion, with Penelope and Shailene and, you know, all the stuff that happens in the factory and all those conversations. And that's a very specific kind of aesthetic. And then you get to the racing and it's, you know, it's all visceral and high energy and disorienting, you know?
Penelope fucking crushed it.
Yeah, she's amazing.
I did, finishing that thought on the sets, the argument between them in the living room, for whatever reason, I was really enamored with that scene visually.
Yeah.
Was that kind of a similar thing? I saw like a behind the scenes shot where it looked like there was just some like two banks up top.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, he wanted to move the camera a lot in that space, which is always scary for me. So that was a situation where I hung some lights up in advance and I hung some light mats so that I would have the ability to adjust quickly. And we blocked that scene on the day. So,
oh, wow.
You know, it wasn't like we rehearsed that. You know, Mike rehearsed it in the office with them and sort of, you know, started to work on the tone and the rhythm of it, I think. But in terms of the, you know, up on its feet staging, we rehearsed it that morning and shot it. So I kind of had a rough idea of how he was going to lay it out, but not really. And I knew that he wanted to move the camera. And I threw up some backlight and I, you know, sort of up above where the practicals were so I could wrap the practicals a little bit. And then, you know, he put Penelope in the middle of that room sitting on the chair. And I just put a, you know, like a muslin china ball above her. And, you know, I was watching the rehearsal and she was doing this thing where she would kind of like look down. And then when she's powerful, she'd raise her chin. And she has this hair, you know, sort of like protects her face from everything. And I said to her, I said, Penelope, is that how you're going to play it? Are you going to play it like that? And she said, why? And I said, well, I'm thinking about doing this thing where I deliberately don't put any light on your face when you're looking down. And then when you look up, you just have the slightest kind of thing. And that's like an interesting accent, you know, it's like an interesting kind of punctuation point for the performance. If you're going to play it like that, I think, you know, but that's kind of, and she loved that. She was like, oh, cool. Yeah. Let's, okay. That's interesting. She kind of can play to the light a little bit. Right.
Right.
So yeah, when her head is down, you can almost like, you can't see her at all. And then she just raises her, and it's just this little bit, you know. I mean, it's pretty down. That scene's down, but it has my favorite shot. My favorite shot in the movie is her standing next to the lamp when she's really giving it to him. You know,
yeah.
It's like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's got this kind of leather feel to it. It's got a, you know, it's real, you know, almost like you can smell the incense in the room or whatever. You know, it smells like candles. It should have like the air is heavy in that place. You know.
Yeah. The other thing that got everyone, the other thing that got everyone was when she actually takes a shot at him towards the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
Dog, the mix was a little loud in that theater that day, but boy, that had every old head in the room. Including me.
Good.
Yeah, that was fun. Also, the catch lights. You nailed all the catch lights. There's always like just a little bit of something special in everyone's eye all the time. And I was like, I love the art of a good catch light.
Well, you know, you can get away with so much if you can see a reflection in somebody's eyes.
Mm.
You know, it's like, well, my entire career, there's someone in the background saying, isn't it a little dark?
Oh.
You know? That's why, like, my joke is always, it's not dark, it's rich. Shut up, you know?
Yeah.
But there's always somebody But really, you know, it took me a little while to figure it out, but really what they're reacting to is they want to see the eyes, you know, and that's always, you know, studio executives and account executives at commercials. And they're like, we want to see their eyes. It's like, well, fair enough. I get it. Of course. That doesn't mean you have to put a shamir on somebody's face to see their eyes. You know, it just, but the, it's true. You know, the expression of emotion, the drama is all in the subtlety of the eyes and, you know, where the eyes are looking and how open they are, how expressive they are, how frequently they're blinking, things like that. Right. And, you know, Gordon Willis does it better than anybody. I mean, the stuff in Godfather, God, I mean, he's like, you know, he probably had a 300 watt Fresnel with a bunch of paper in it stuck right next to the lens, you know, right. But it's four under, but it reflects enough. So, you know, you might, in some of my work, usually I find I can get away with, you know, three, four stops under of actual exposure on someone's face if I get a really pinpoint eyelight in the eyes. And usually that's, you know, my experience more powerful than just putting a bunch of front line on somebody's face. It's, you know, the scene is, you know, in really dramatic scenes where it's appropriate to be moody. It's, I mean, it's not like I'm saying, oh, it's everything, every shot should look like Clute, you know?
Right. Right.
But yeah, it's important. It's like, it can be down, but there's this weird trend now in particularly in television where everything is just really muddy. And I think like that's okay. But if you don't have, you can't see, what a performer's doing with their face, it you really lose out. You're missing out on an opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I think I have a theory, not being in these rooms, but that, you know, when television more recently was like able to be more quote unquote cinematic, everyone started shooting that way. Like, oh, so the cinema's dark, you know, and it's like, right. Oh, no, it's rich. But the problem being people's internet connections.
Right.
So like, even if it did, you know, using Game of Thrones as the kind of ultimate example, like even if on set, this actually goes to your idea about looking at the fucking monitor instead of like a meter or whatever. But even if on set and in the grade, it looked perfect. It's like no one has an LG C1, like right. Watching it, you know, perfectly in a backlit room and all that.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And, you know, that's a push pull. It's like, do you need to do your work for the lowest common denominator of the viewer, or do you hold the viewer accountable? You know, it's like, okay, I'm personally in the second part of it. It's like, I'm not going to dumb down the work because 15% of the population is watching it on a shitty LCD television. You know, it's like, right. I get it. Everyone has different resources and, you know, but don't watch it on a shitty LCD television and then complain to me about how it looks. You know, it's like,
right, right.
I can't control everyone's experience. And, you know, the truth is like, we never have been able to. It's, you know, you go into certain parts of this country or, you know, other parts of the world in cinemas, there's all sorts of stuff where, you know, they change the bulb when the bulb burns out, not when it's below 14-foot Lamberts. You know, there's really bad vignetting or, you know, things are out of focus or it's a silver screen and it's a laser projector and it's like all sorts of mismatched, really poor projection, you know, and it's historically, it's a systemic problem. You know, if as a cinematographer, you start to really worry about that, you're not going to sleep very well at night. You know, I think it's like, okay, well, I have to be considerate of the kind of global change. You know, maybe I don't set all my blacks at zero units all the time because 80% of the population has their dynamic mode on and it's going to really crush it. Like you have to be considerate of that, you know. But it doesn't, like, I have to do what I think is right for the director and, you know, and the movie too. You know, it's like I can't just like.
Well, it does, you know, make me think about, you know, because the last four projects you did with Fincher are all Netflix. Am I over? Yeah. Is that four? Man, it doesn't matter. Three at least.
Three.
And actually, Michael Mann did say, I don't know if he told you this, but I assume he did, but he said that he hired you off the back of Mank.
That's true. I think, yeah, I mean, he called me to do to do Tokyo Vice, and then I couldn't do it because the schedule shifted and I was already on Devotion. So, but yeah, he liked me. Yeah,
I did too. But do you guys have to, you know, working exclusively for Netflix? I don't know if those are, do those Blu-rays come out? Because I'd love to buy them. I assume.
No, I have no idea.
Because I got, these are all my, finally, this is my nerd collection. Do you have to make certain considerations for, like you were saying, or do you just shoot it as if it were going to be in theaters and go from there? Because those films tend to be darker.
Yeah, I think we make one version. I mean, there's an HDR version and an SDR version.
Sure.
But we make the HDR version first because I believe it's the best. You know, it's the most, it's the best example of how we think it should look. To me, the difference of the home movie experience versus the cinema experience is not really image quality. It's the size of the screen.
Like timing.
Yeah. Like, you know, this thing that's super common now, you know, people shoot large format and they're, you know, shoot everything at a 1:3 and it's like, there's nothing in the frame and focus except for what's in the, you know, immediate foreground or whatever. That looks so cool on an iPad.
Yeah.
It looks so cool. Well, you see that on a 40-foot screen. I'm like looking around trying to figure out what part of the frame to look at sometimes, you know? And I think people get really seduced by that because they look at it on an iPad in dailies, and then they look at it on a, you know, a little monitor on the set, and they're like, oh my God, it looks so cool. It's like, well, yeah, it does look cool here, you know, when you're looking at it like that. But you start to, you know, you sit back at it and you look at, you know, at the IMAX theater, you know, Universal City Walk or whatever, it's an entirely different experience. And sometimes I think it can be really off-putting. And, you know, that's, and, you know, so we take that stuff into consideration for sure.
Sure.
You want people to have a great experience in both places. And it's like, so ultimately, like, I never think about really like how cool the shot looks. It's like, does the shot accomplish the story beat that's required here? You know, I think people oftentimes they make the decision from the other side of it. And like, oh, well, what's the coolest thing we can do? It's, and that's a very, you know, really a commercial kind of concept, you know, but
totally.
Yeah.
I did want to, quickly stop by the killer in terms of lighting again, this cinematography podcast. It felt very much like I don't want to say this pejoratively, but like the formula was firing on all cylinders. Like it felt like everything that, you know, I've ever read about, you know, David's kind of process and now your process of the past few films, like all of it kind of came together. Honestly, the only thing that threw me off was, is this handheld or is this done in post? And I figured it was a mix, but apparently it never was.
No, not really. I mean, there's probably four real handheld shots in the movie.
I couldn't pick them
like
out.
Like the one, like where we're chasing Michael down the yard in the beginning when he finds his house has been broken into. That's really handheld.
Okay.
Shot on the dolly that precedes that is really handheld. There's no handheld shots in the fight sequence.
Right.
You know, yeah, it's a little, but there's not many real ones. I mean, I'm glad you couldn't tell. That's good.
Yeah. Do you know if it was just key for, this is the nerdiest fucking question I'll ask you. Do you know if it was key framed or if like, cause I know like, do you know Vashi? Of course, you know Vashi. He worked on other stuff. Did you use his little handheld presets?
No.
He's had those out forever. And I'm like, did people just drop and plug and play those now?
You know, what we did is I shot some like framing charts, basically focus charts at the rental house.
Yeah.
Various degrees. I mean, basically it was like no caffeine, little bit of caffeine, another shot of espresso. I'm like, we got, and then they had, you know, they have tracking markers on them. The post guys will grab, and that was like a place to start.
Sure.
And then keyframe and adjust, you know?
Yeah.
I
think that's how he made them. But, anyway, back to the light. I was looking at the ASC mag earlier this morning, and it gives nothing away because it's literally like one shot has a neg floppy and then one shot has nothing at all. And I was wondering, like, that's clearly the most minimal approach. What was kind of the most maximal approach?
You mean in terms of the use of equipment?
Yeah, because the past couple of things you've done, that kind of seems to have been the theme. And, you know, we were talking about it earlier, that overall you kind of just keep things real simple. But especially with David, you and David's work, I've noticed it's become more and more simple. And I know that you guys have said it's you know, I can't remember if it was you or Eigel who had mentioned that, like, I think it was Eigel when he was talking about House of Cards, how, like, the camera car needed to be up in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I just love that idea because I hate setting up anything.
Well, you know, the thing is, once you, the second you work with more exposure than is on the set, naturally, you have to add it everywhere, you know, in proportion, right? So if I'm in a set that's sort of naturally lit, 12 foot candles or whatever, and then I bring in light through the window that now makes it 50 foot candle, but, you know, the background's gonna be dark. That's not a complicated concept, right? But then the choices start to necessitate other choices, and it's really easy to build things that way. So, like, I always look at it like, okay, what's the absolute minimal I have to do here to make this workable aesthetically and also logistically, you know? And so if I can use a bunch of practicals in the background and I don't have to light the background, I just have to work with the foreground, then it's really easy. It's like, well, how much light's the background give me? Okay, cool. That means I got to light the whole set. I got to light the actors to 12 foot candles or whatever. And then I just have to turn a couple things off and we can shoot, you know, and make it kind of look the way we want to. Right. Probably the most elaborate setup on The Killer was the night exterior outside the Brute House. But it wasn't the thing that made it elaborate was all the streetlights we put in, and we put 5K tungsten bulbs in, I'm sure, you know. It wasn't, you know, I had a condor deep in the background that was just lighting some trees. And then we had a condor over the house for the fire effects when the house is on fire. That's it. I mean, it's not like, you know, you read these American cinematographer articles where everyone's like, they're, you know, showing their lighting diagrams. Like, to me, that's kind of like, it's kind of the wrong concept to give students. It's like, oh, you know, like, if only I had all these sky panels. It's like, well, probably had all that stuff because the set didn't do a lot of it itself. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And
well, that is something that I try to do in these conversations is, like, I used to be way more specific about it in, like, the first season. And then now I've started just asking for, like, generalizations, but, you know, sometimes the type of light matters, but, cause I found in my, like you're saying, those lighting plots, even, like, you'll go on, Deakins's website and he's got all these crazy lighting plots together, which obviously putting one up that says, like, we had one key light isn't gonna make anyone come to your website. But if you can simplify everything, you just go, oh, big top light. All right, I can figure that out. You know, maybe when you're super beginner, it there's too many other questions beyond, you know, the top light.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to know the equipment in a way where it's going to tell you what, you have to know what you're going for when you ask for the piece of equipment, you know, and you have to know it well enough to know that it's going to give you the tools. And that's experience. I think, in Roger's work is so brilliant because it's everything is very appropriate for what he's doing, but it's so shot specific. It's like, there's also a lot of decisions, a lot of lighting decisions are made unrelated to the resulting anticipated aesthetic. You know, for example, like in my work anyway, like where almost 90% of my equipment needs are schedule driven. They're not visual driven. You know, it's like, and you might walk in a location and be like, man, if we shoot this at 8:30 a.m. between 8:30 and 9:45, it's going to look awesome. We don't have to do anything. You know, and the director's like, yeah, cool. Okay, we can do that. Like, you know, it's really simple. See, we can do it in two shots. Great. And then the AD comes over and they said, well, you know, it's going to be, we're in splits the night before. We're not going to be able to start here till 11. And we have to make the company move. And then So, you know, it's actually, there's no chance we're going to be here until 4 PM. And it's like, okay, well, now I need a condor and I need all this stuff. And then they look at me and they're like, why do you need all this stuff? It's like, well, like, I want to shoot at 8 AM, you know? Like,
I tried to help you out.
Yeah, I tried to help. But it's like, what do you want me to do about it? You know, it's, I think people don't entirely understand that. You know, it's like a lot of these big Marvel movies, you know, they have these super elaborate setups. It's because they have no idea when the cast is going to show up.
Right.
You know, so you got all these construction cranes out there. There's nothing fun about having construction cranes on the set. I got to tell you, it's a pain in the ass. But if you don't know when Iron Man's going to show up, and it could be at any time, it's like, well, I better have an ability to block the light out there, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to kind of buy yourself the tools so that you can deliver on the day, because that's the expectation. Because when they do show up, you better be ready, you know? But like, I don't know, if I had the choice, I like, you know, there's no part of me at all where it's like, I have to have 48 footers around me all the time. Like, that's just terrifying. It's a cold pain in the ass, cart all that crap around and figure out places to stage it and all that stuff. You know, it's like, right. Much rather work with two lights if we can, you know?
Well, and I assume the novelty wears off the first time you do it. First time you're like, look at me, I'm a big DP. And then after that, you're like, wow, that's fucking sucks.
Well, you know, I mean, it's, you have to repent for everything as a DP, you know, like all of your choices are judged and you're taking resources away from the director anytime you ask for those things, you know, it's like,
right.
I would much rather have that money go towards art department stuff, you know, it's like, it's so much more important than having a bunch of equipment sitting in a truck that I may or may not need. It's like, no, let's take the money and put it in their set dressing or paint, or, you know, like let's build it out of steel instead of plywood, so it actually looks good, you know, or whatever. Like, let's, what do we have to do? That, you know, the kind of machismo part of it where it's like, look at all this stuff. It's like, well, yeah. I mean, it's just also doesn't make you very nimble. You know, it's like, oh, can't count the number of times where it's like, wow, look at that. Look at the sky over there. We should turn around. Oh shit. Well, all the trucks.
Right.
Okay. Well, can't get that shot, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that is something that I've learned from you and a few others, the importance of speed over a lot of things, you know? But
yeah.
I did want to ask, because I know you said you had to go pretty soon. Because you're my basically first returning guest, second returning guest, is there anything that you comes to mind that you've learned between Devotion and The Killer that you've started to apply maybe specifically or maybe generally? That would be a different question.
I mean, I now I really ask for a lot of prep.
Mm.
Yeah. Like I'd rather, I mean, to be honest, I would prefer to just prep the movie and never shoot it. Like nothing would make me happier than to just prep the movie, because it's like, that's where all the dreaming happens, you know? It's like, the second you get on the set, that's where every compromise happens. You know, it's like, oh, that thing you wanted to do 2 weeks ago, that's not going to happen. It's like, oh, but it was such a great idea, you know? And the prep, like that whole, like, it's not fix it in post, it should be fix it in prep.
Right.
And I, you know, even if the director has it totally figured out, being a fly on the wall in those early director scouts and pointing certain things out, or having those early conversations with the designer or the set decorator or the location manager, it just pays so much dividends ultimately in the movie for me. And so that's now pretty important. And then the other thing is, like, I really feel quite strongly that grading is sort of almost equally important to the shooting process. And it's like, you know, the whole concept of, you know, Ansel Adams, it was like, you know, half of his job was printing.
Yep.
You know, I mean, half of what he talked, you know,
one of three books that are this fucking thick.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exposed to the hollow spirit of the shadows kind of thing. And so, you know, for me, the you know, it's not color correction. You know, it's where the soup gets seasoned ultimately, you know, it's that final step in the cooking process. And I don't believe it's where you find the look, you know, or you like, that's not where the look should come from, or, you know, otherwise it just, stuff looks really graded to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that last 2% is the hardest 2%, you know, it's the hardest percentage to get. And it takes time. And yeah. It really just takes a lot of time. Yeah.
Well, and to your point about, I've spent the past basically all the pandemic and the and before that and the strikes, like just learning how to color grade my own stuff. Because I will literally at this point on most gigs be like, and I will color it. Like right. You might have a guy, I'm willing to like, you know, give you examples, and if you go with them, fine. But you know better than me. But I can save us some money, and it'll look the way I want.
Sure,
the way we want, whatever. But to your point about prep, I'm not the biggest fan of David Lynch's films, but I fucking love his approach. Like his all like even his Masterclass, which I saw a bunch of people going like, this doesn't teach us filmmaking. I'm like, it absolutely does. It absolutely teaches you what you were saying, like the dreaming and the ideation and the sort of the, he would probably call it the spirituality of it. Where you do get to make those decisions and where the fun happens. You know, the way you put it was actually excellent. The dreaming happens, or the fun happens in pre, and the compromises happen in production. That's a great way to put it.
No, totally. I mean, it's where, you know, it's like my joke is always, it's filmmaking is 12 weeks of hope followed by 16 weeks of disappointment. You know, it's like, and the problem is as you're shooting, you're chiseling it in stone, ultimately, to some degree, mm-hmm. You know, that's why, like, I'm not nostalgic about the photochemical process, because I'm perpetually dissatisfied with what we do. And it's like, man, I always want another opportunity to improve it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like, you know, nobody walks out of the movie theater and says, well, at least they made their day.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
the schedule was held so well.
Yeah. I mean, God, it's like, I mean, the movie didn't really hit for me, but I mean, at least everybody broke for lunch on time. You know, it's like, those things are important, but not to the audience.
Right.
You know, I fight harder now than I used to for the things I know are going to matter that we're not going to be able to fix later.
Gotcha.
I fight way harder for that stuff now.
Well, you also have the sort of CV to back it up now. I'm sure when you were newer, it was a bit harder to get people to listen to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's always hard to get people to listen to you. it's like, you know, but, but, you know, the other thing that I think is really important that I've learned a lot is that usually everybody on the film set has a different set of, they have a different idea of what success looks like, you know, like they have a different idea of what, how they feel when they walk away and they're like, that was a great day. Like, you know, the actors have a completely different perception of what that means than the line producer. You know, or the
right.
and the more you understand that, the more you understand what everyone else's agenda is in terms of how they perceive a good day, means you can navigate it much easier. You know, it's like no one has my perspective on what represents a great day except for me. And I always like try to like get myself in the director's shoes of like, well, what does the director see as a great day? Okay, how do I kind of get myself at least we're a unified force towards everyone else that has completely differing ideas. You know, like, you know, the studio that gets the cost report and the production report at the end of every day, they have a very limited perception of whether or not that day was successful. Did you shoot the call sheet? Did you break for lunch on time? What's the meal penalties? How many pre-calls did you have? You know, that all, you know, the cinematographer, is responsible for a lot of those things ultimately. And there's a very weird metric for how that's judged. And it's not dailies, you know?
Right.
And you know, you have to get good at kind of, playing that game to some degree, I think, so that everybody walks away and they're like, oh, that was a great day, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you go getting on to your, whatever it is you got going, but, thanks again for chilling with me. I'd, always love to have you back, maybe get a little, deeper. It's hard to balance two films coming out back to back and like try to give them equal attention.
No problem.
Yeah, man, thanks again. And you make really, really good compromises, bud.
No, thank you. It's not easy. Yeah. All right, buddy.
All right, take care, man.
Nice to talk to you. Cheers.
You too, brother.
Bye.
Frame and Reference is an Owlbot production. It's produced and edited by me, Kenny McMillan, and distributed by Pro Video Coalition. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going to frameandrefpod.com and clicking the link to buy me a coffee. It's always appreciated, and as always, Thanks for listening.